Okay, wait. What about this? Instead of what is Jay Powell thinking in five words or less, what if we change it to what is the ghost of Paul Volcker thinking in five words or less? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 7th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I am not saying it makes much sense, but this is one of those macroeconomic days when what you might ordinarily consider good news might actually not be so good news, maybe even bad news, even though it's really good news. I speak here of this morning's September jobs report in a very confusing manner, I understand, about its robustness. So we are going to dig right in. Gina Smilek's at the New York Times. Sadiq Reddy is at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Gina,
let me ask you, first of all, so we'll give you the numbers. 263,000 new jobs in the economy last month. Unemployment rate falls to 3.5%. I think you either wrote in the Times this morning or you tweeted, this changes nothing, right?
From the Fed's perspective, yes, this changes nothing. I think, you know, this is still a very strong labor market with a very big labor shortage. And from their perspective, that means that wages are going to continue rising. And, you know, as we all know, if the wages at your local restaurant are still going up, it's likely that the prices are also going to continue going up. And so I think all of their concerns that this labor market is still pretty inflationary remain very firmly intact.
Okay, so Sudeep, it is really important to point out here that people getting jobs is a good thing.
People getting jobs is a good thing. People getting reasonable wage increases is a good thing. But a shortage of labor, as we're seeing in the economy, just creates so much strain for everybody. This is why inflation has flipped from a goods problem, all the supply chain issues that we dealt with last year. Now we're seeing it more as a services problem, which is obviously due to those labor constraints. And when you have that, you're just going to see low-end wages keep rising, which generally would be good. But if it's going to keep inflation up, that doesn't really help when you net it out. And so that's the problem that the Fed is grappling with right now, is how do you keep the labor market in a decent shape without keeping inflation at this relatively elevated level, even if it has come down a bit.
So let's move away from the labor market here for a second, Gina, and let me ask you about some deflationary things that are coming down the pike, right? I saw this week that shipping costs have plummeted dramatically. The growth in housing prices has slowed. I mean, there are some things coming that lead people to say, you know what, why do you keep hammering on inflation when it looks like things are getting better?
Yeah, I think that this is a big question, and it's something people are starting to ask. That said, and not to sound like a complete curmudgeon, but a lot of those...
That's my job on this show. Come on.
Often my job as well. A lot of those positives are not sort of sure bets. You know, they're things that could take a while to feed through. The kind of slowing we're seeing in the housing market, that's not going to trickle into the kind of housing prices we measure in inflation for a while. That slowing we're seeing in shipping, it could take a long time for that to get passed on to the end consumer, and things could get disrupted in between. And so I just think that those hopeful spots are good news, and you know, we should be excited about them, but they're just not enough for monetary policymakers to bet the house on just yet.
Sudeep, the last time we had Gina on, we talked a little bit about the long and variable lag, right, that Milton Friedman talked about with monetary policy in this economy. So I'm going to ask you a version of the same question. We have now gone from a standing start to relatively restrictive monetary policy, you know, based on where interest rates have been the last, you know, decade or so, in a big, bad hurry. And we haven't had time for the long and variable lag of monetary policy effects to take effect. Is it possible, do you think, that the Fed is overshooting here?
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of people at the Fed recognize the possibility that they're overshooting. And they probably recognize the risks of overshooting, but they also are sitting there worrying about, well, what if they're wrong? Because they have been wrong. They were wrong throughout much of last year. Yeah. And we've ended up in this situation that you don't want to make the same mistake twice. And so they're going to sit there and think, okay, at least let's get it right this time, since we didn't get it right last time, and just take the pain and deal with it to make sure we're right this time, and not dealing with a Paul Volcker kind of situation where it's 4 or 5 or 6 years of this kind of turmoil that's throwing everybody for a loop year after year. And obviously he came in and was able to put an end to that, but it was painful to deal with.
Right. Well, so since you mentioned Paul Volcker, and hopefully you two were paying attention in the open, because now we're going to play my favorite game with a twist. And Gina, I'm going to go to you first, because to get the plug in there again, you're writing a book on the Fed and you've studied this. I want to know from you, in as many words as you need, actually, you don't have to take just five, what Paul Volcker's ghost would say about what's going on right now, and more importantly, what the Fed is doing right now.
Not again. I feel like his phrase was two words. I feel like that would be his phrase. But I think that's because, you know, Volcker talked a lot before he died about this idea that the sort of disinflation that he had secured, that, you know, America paid so much to secure, we had really high unemployment to get that, was something that needed to be guarded very carefully. You know, he always felt that it was a tenuous victory, that it could be eroded, that we needed to be cautious not to take it for granted and not to squander it. And I think he'd be very worried to see what is happening today.
Sudeep, same question to you. Paul Volcker's ghost shows up. What does he say?
You know, if he's got five words, he will say pain now beats pain later. that is the lesson of his tenure. But he would also be looking at this thing, at this situation, and saying, I told you so. You can't let your guard down. And this is where Fed officials really for the last decade were kind of tripped up by the fact that inflation was so low, and they thought, well, it's a completely new normal. Things have changed. And I don't think any of us have really come to grips with the fact that again, the labor market being so tight has created a very different dynamic. Some of it's due to less immigration, some of it's due to pandemic effects, but it's just a very different situation. It shows you that the economy is not going to, the economic trends can change at any moment, and you have to always be vigilant in that way. And he would not be pleased with what we're seeing today.
Yeah. Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Gina Smilek at the New York Times on a Friday afternoon, a Jobs Day Friday. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a great weekend. On Wall Street today, as I said, bad news. Details, numbers, y'all know the drill. It can be helpful every now and then, I think, to step back and ponder the what if, just to get a little context. You know, I mean, sure, the job market is real good right now, given where this economy's been the last 2.5 years. There are 500,000 more jobs than there were before the pandemic. The unemployment rate is basically the same. But still, what if? What if the pandemic hadn't happened? Where might this economy and the labor market be then, do you suppose? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman with today's experiment in counterfactual economic history.
500,000 more jobs seems pretty decent. But, says University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson, if there'd been no pandemic and job growth had stayed on the same trajectory it was on between 2015 and 2020,
we would have had 5 million more jobs, not 500,000 more jobs.
And the jobs we got would have been different.
A lot of our job growth prior to the pandemic came from education and health services.
Boy, did the pandemic derail that train. Employment has struggled to recover, let alone grow to meet new demand. If not for the pandemic's health dangers, a lot more baby boomers would still be working, says Harvard economist Jason Furman.
At this point, you're primarily talking about men over the age of 55 who have exited the labor force and have not returned.
In our imaginary no-COVID world, we'd have more waiters and cooks, fewer folks punching in at Amazon and Target warehouses. John Lear at polling firm Morning Consult says consumers haven't gone back to their pre-COVID ways.
They continue to spend less time in restaurants, going out. More of their money is spent on delivery items in their house, and the jobs have essentially followed that change in consumer preferences.
In some ways, though, October 2022 doesn't look so different from where things were headed in February 2020. Unemployment was as low as it is now, and wages were rising, especially for low-paid workers. Those wages just aren't going as far now, because what we didn't have much of in 2020 was inflation. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There's some semiconductor news of note today. First of all, the Biden administration announced new limits on chip technology sales to China. Think weaponry that they're building. Think supercomputers, right? Also, some news of regular chip sales here. They're not really selling is the deal. Samsung said this morning profits are going to be down 32% in the third quarter over last year. AMD figures profits are looking weak as well. People are just buying fewer computers, so there's less demand for chips, which ain't a bad thing given how tight semiconductor supplies have been of late. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, the semiconductor shortage is not over just yet.
Now that people aren't buying as many computers and computer parts, computer manufacturers don't need as many semiconductor chips, says Stacy Razgon, an analyst at Bernstein.
If I'm Dell or HP or something, I sell PCs, but I just don't buy any processors, and I just use the ones I already have on the shelf.
As a result, he says the semiconductor shortage is starting to turn into a glut, at least when it comes to the chips that go into laptops and smartphones, says Glenn O'Donnell with the research company Forrester.
We may not have a shortage of chips on the high end, but we still have a shortage of chips on the low end.
O'Donnell says lower-end chips are used in different products, like vehicles. That means you can't just take a chip out of a PC and drop it into an F-150. And unlike electronics, vehicles are still in high demand. David Whiston, an auto analyst at Morningstar, says the surplus of high-end chips could eventually benefit auto manufacturers.
They can help the chip makers perhaps reallocate some production capacity back towards automotive. That's not something you can do in a week or two, though.
Meanwhile, automakers are trying to figure out how to adjust their production. Alan Amici, CEO of the Center for Automotive Research, says that means allocating their chips to vehicles with higher profit margins.
So pickup trucks and SUVs. You know, if you're looking for a car that, you know, maybe a small car or, you know, something that isn't necessarily a high profit car, automakers may not be building those right now.
Amici says he expects a shortage of low-end chips to constrain auto production well into next year. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And they're recruiting influencers.
LinkedIn just ain't what it used to be, gang. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, big wah-wahs. Dow Industrials down 630 points today, 2.1%, 29,296. The NASDAQ gave up 420 points, 3.8%. Finished at 10,652. The S&P 500 down 104 points, 2.8%, close at 36 and 39. For the week, though, the Dow rose just shy of 2%. S&P 500 added about 1.5%. NASDAQ picked up just under 0.75%. Here's the deal on this morning's job news, right? It convinced the markets the Fed's going to keep raising interest rates with some feeling behind it, shall we say. And that was bad news for big bank stocks. JP Morgan Chase gave back 2%. Bank of America shrank 2.25%. The bad news from Samsung and AMD that Justin was telling us about. Well, AMD subtracted almost 13.9% today. Intel counted down a little over 5.3%. And that bad news spread to tech stocks. Amazon, which is, we should tell you, a marketplace underwriter, dipped 4.75%. Kind of off and on, Amazon is. I don't know. Bond prices, well, they fell. When that happens, the yield on the 10-year T-note goes up. 3.88% was the interest rate there. You are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a case coming for argument at the Supreme Court next week that, while maybe not one of the biggies of this term that all the early coverage and previews has been about, will nonetheless have real impact on a whole lot of people in this economy. Back in the mid-1980s, Vanity Fair licensed a picture of Prince that photographer Lynn Goldsmith had taken. Paid her $400. Then the magazine commissioned Andy Warhol to make one of his trademark screen prints based on Goldsmith's picture to use alongside an article about Prince. 30 years later, Goldsmith discovered that Warhol had actually made 16 works of art instead of just one, and then the lawyers got involved. The legal question before the court next week is whether Warhol violated copyright law by making those extra prints without permission, or whether he maybe transformed the picture into something completely new. The economic question, as Marketplace's Peter Balanon Rosen reports, is about how artists make art and whether they get paid for it.
Andy Warhol used plenty of images he didn't create. His Marilyn Monroe's, a reworking of a promo for the film Niagara. His Jackie Kennedy's, news clippings. His Campbell's soup can, a can of soup.
To create a portrait just like Andy Warhol, there's a few steps that I would take.
In the lobby of the Andy Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, Caroline Mead demos his process. You take an image, reduce it to black and white, burn it onto a silk screen.
And then give it a tight pull.
Paint a canvas in bright colors, silkscreen the original image on top, and boom.
This is completely transformed from what I started, and I did this all with one screen and a little bit of paint.
Warhol used tools of mass production and pop culture symbols to raise these questions.
Is this a ripoff? What is ripoff? What is original? What is authentic?
Which is pretty much the question the Supreme Court will have to answer. Did Warhol rip off Goldsmith's photo of Prince? Goldsmith declined to comment, but photographer Jeff Sedlick knows her situation. He's licensed photos out, but he's also seen plenty of his work, like a famous portrait of Miles Davis, show up in others' art and tattoos. No credit, no license, no money.
My whole existence as a business person in the arts and as an artist depends on copyright law. I need to know that I'm able to generate income from my various photographs.
Lawyers for the Andy Warhol Foundation say Warhol transformed Goldsmith's photo into a comment on the nature of celebrity. In 2019, a federal district court agreed, saying it was an example of what's known as fair use. Basically, using it without permission was fair. But an appeals court said, no. Warhol retained essential elements of Goldsmith's photo. He didn't transform it enough. Now the Supreme Court has to decide what type of use is fair.
Traditionally, fair use has protected building on prior works.
Jane Ginsburg, law professor at Columbia University, says not all building is fair. She says courts consider why something was used without permission, like the last time the Supreme Court looked at artistic fair use in the 90s.
The song Pretty Woman, the Roy Orbison song.
Pretty woman, walking down the street.
It was parodied by a rap group called Two Live Crew.
The court ruled the parody was fair use because it wasn't just a cover. It transformed a 60s ballad into a rap commentary.
Commenting on the naivete of the original work.
Latif Matima teaches law at Howard University and directs the Institute of Intellectual Property and Social Justice. He says there's another important factor courts look at when deciding if something's fair use.
What impact would this unauthorized use have on the commercial market for the underlying work?
In this case, could Warhol's portrait be a market substitute for Goldsmith's photo and crowd it out of the market? Questions like this are largely left up to judges' discretion. Matima points out that leaves the door open for biases about certain groups.
Groups that for other reasons are marginalized and placed lower on the social infrastructure.
A lot of people are paying attention to this case. Fan fiction creators say limiting fair use could hurt their community. Recording industry reps have told the court a broad interpretation would undermine their ability to, quote, protect their valuable copyrights. Brooklyn artist Deborah Cass, who serves on the Andy Warhol Foundation board, says preserving visual artists' ability to incorporate others' work into their own is important.
I think when you use pre-existing language, whether it's other people's art or painting or art history, there's a common language others can read.
The Supreme Court will see whether they read Warhol's work as fair use or a potentially illegal ripoff of Goldsmith during arguments next week. I'm Peter Balanon Rosen for Marketplace.
We started the show with jobs, so now we're going to end the show with jobs. Kinda. Granted, it's been a long while since I actually used LinkedIn for anything beyond just out of curiosity, but the last time I checked, LinkedIn was a place to put your best professional foot forward in search of a job, wasn't it? Well, here is a status update on how people are using it now. They're using it too much, perhaps, and also perhaps too personally. Laura Kelly is a business reporting fellow at the New York Times. Laura, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
So look, I'm going to get straight to it. How did, as the headline of this piece says, how did LinkedIn become a place to overshare? I mean, aren't there plenty of places to overshare that, where you don't have to do it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And something that I was so curious about. I just personally, over the last several months, have noticed in my own LinkedIn feed, people posting everything from crying selfies to posts about illnesses and personal challenges. And I think that a big part of this was people were working from home, people were seeing their kids in the background of calls. So it really is a shift that people are posting about things like burnout and mental illness and some of the more personal challenges that are affecting their work.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I can get the post about burnout, right? Because that's completely germane and relevant to the professional environment these days. And, you know, it happens everywhere, right? I guess the question is, what does LinkedIn, the executives say about it, because fundamentally they have to run a business and they need to be attuned to how their users are feeling about their experiences on their platform, right?
Definitely. You know, LinkedIn is walking a pretty fine line here. Their executives are neither encouraging nor discouraging personal posts. They've definitely noticed a spike in personal posts, but they're not, like I said, really encouraging or discouraging. Interestingly, something that they are doing is trying to build up LinkedIn as a content creation site. They have this new program they started last year called the Content Creator Accelerator Program, and they're recruiting influencers and providing them support to post, ideally about topics like leadership or things that are sort of traditionally more relevant to LinkedIn.
So basically, they're looking for virality, just like every other user of every other social network is, right?
You know, that's a good question. So actually, Daniel Roth, who's the editor-in-chief of LinkedIn, told me that they sometimes get worried when they see things going viral. So again, it's this sort of fine line. That being said, creators and people on the site are noticing that they're getting benefits from going viral. One person who was in the Content Creator Accelerator program, an influencer who works under the name Natalie Rose, and she told me that when she posted a crying selfie about anxiety and some of the stresses of being an influencer, it went totally viral. It got millions of impressions, and it led her to get some business opportunities.
So it worked, right? I mean, so in that case, I guess it worked. And that's, so it's good that she did that for her.
Yeah, it served her purposes, it sounds like.
All right, so look, this is why I should have done a little reporting before I got in the studio with you, and I should have gone on your LinkedIn profile and checked out what you checked out what you've posted. Where are you on the personal professional boundary on this thing?
Personally, I basically just use LinkedIn to post about my articles.
Right.
So it was definitely fun to post this particular article on LinkedIn when it came out.
What kind of buzz did you get? Have you gotten reactions?
I would say I've got the sort of normal amount of engagement. Huh. You know, a few people said congrats, the people from my high school liked it, and that sort of thing.
Laura Kelly, she is a business reporting fellow at the New York Times. She wrote a big piece about LinkedIn and how it's the new Facebook, kind of, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, Laura, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me on. This has been fun.
This final note on the way out today, we have been keeping an eye on seasonal hiring the past month or so as big retailers gear up for the holidays. So far, the vibe has been less hiring rather than more, but today's entry in the database is from Amazon, which said today it's going to hire 150,000 people to handle the rush. All right, we are out of here, but here is your moment of economic context. Should you have been in the market for a couple of 100,000 barrels of crude oil this week? Well, the Biden administration was selling. The Energy Department announced this morning it has sold 10.2 million barrels of crude from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It's the White House, of course, trying to keep oil and gas prices down in the face of that OPEC plus quota cut from earlier this week. Brent crude today, by the way, that is the global benchmark and seems relevant right now, up 3%, $97.86 a barrel at the close in New York. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.